if you allow the nuclear plants to make big profits on a 20-year contract to provide power, what that does is it competes with other forms of truly renewable energy.
Here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere, anytime, on the internet, WFPR.FM, and in the local Franklin, Mass. FM radio dial 102.9. Here today in our glorious studio with my climate guide, Ted McIntyre. Ted, how are you doing this Tuesday?
I'm just doing peachy, Steve. Glad to be here. Glad to be here in the yellow room.
In the yellow room, yes. Kind of almost sunlight reflecting.
Well, a beautiful June day out there. Sort of.
It
got kind of, it was nice this morning, clear, then it got overcast, that sort of still, mild. Very nice. Very nice.
Yeah, there was some report when I was listening to the weather that there might be some occasional showers passing through in certain areas. So we're in a position where if it doesn't exactly drop on us, we can still see the clouds come by, and it's dropping on somebody else. Such as it is, yes. And I also saw, I just thought of it, NOAA had a tropical depression in the Gulf of Coast today.
So
they're starting to track it.
There you go.
Starting to track it.
I'll have to take a look. In the Gulf Coast, yes, yes. There's... We talked about this last time, the potential number of storms coming this
forecast
year.
Is
forecast, right?
Gonna be, it's going to be a prolific season, yeah. Supposedly.
Yeah. So yes. We'll see.
Yes, for sure. So I think sustainability director came up in a couple of ways. Clearly, as part of the Franklin budget cycle, to really ground it there. That had been something that was proposed initially in the budget and then fell out as the realities of the rest of the processing, what the school budget was going to require, the town priorities, et cetera. It didn't make the final cut, if you will. And then a number of folks, our fellow neighbors, et cetera, stood up and said, oh, by the way, it is a position that does pay for itself because of some of the grants, et cetera, that can be obtained. So from a sustainability question, I agree in principle. Clearly, we need somebody to try and focus the town's efforts. The town, as we've talked before, does make a lot of good steps. We're
just to back up, we're saying that here in Franklin, there is a discussion about hiring a sustainability
director, manager, some title,
demigod, whatever, somebody to think about, and it's a point of contention because there's money involved,
correct?
Right? And the argument is going that the position would not, in a sense, pay for itself, but would generate funds through grants. Well, okay. All right. So now I'm up with you. So there's the town of Franklin is worried about should they get a sustainability manager.
Right. And Jamie, at least in the last budget hearing or in some other meeting, acknowledged that it's not that I don't want it. It's just that it's probably not a good time now because of the other budget considerations. And at such point in time, we certainly would reconsider it, but it didn't make the cut now. And then the Globe had an article.
Just the other day, a Globe article revealing the big secret that there's money to be gotten and that sustainability managers, whatever level, right? So it says, are a good thing for a town because what's happened, there's this bill called the Inflation Reduction Act. If you rewind 4 years, President Biden was pushing for a big climate bill. Joe Manchin, who has since left the party and become an independent, right, toyed with running for president, all that kind of stuff. He didn't like it. He didn't like the climate bill that Biden wanted to introduce 4 years ago, right? Round and round and round. Finally, they agreed to something called the Inflation Reduction Act, which is a weird name to satisfy this Mansion guy.
But it ended up as a bipartisan deal.
It got enough votes, yes, to get over the hump and get signed by Biden. But it is a climate bill. And the thing about this Inflation Reduction Act, which we'll probably hear more and more about, is that there are not very many penalties for bad behavior, but there's lots of rewards for good behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Tons of money to do good things.
Right.
Okay. And so that IRA money, and we're talking about, I think it's hundreds of billions over the next decade.
Mucho bucks.
Is spread out in order to help in the climate crisis. And so all of a sudden there's money available for towns, at the money at the federal level available to towns that can take advantage of them. I think it runs the full gamut from protecting the local environment from a climate resiliency perspective mm-hmm. to getting clean energy stuff into your town, preparing for clean energy, all right. kinds of money. It seems that like one example, this is just made up on the spot, but probably the federal government wants to help a town buy electric buses.
Sure.
Right? Boom, boom, right? So all of a sudden there's money there. If you need a bus, right, or you need new buildings, I mean, there's help from the feds.
Mm-hmm.
How do you access that? Well, if you want the money from the feds, you have to apply for it. So, and that's called the grant process. You get a grant from the feds. You need someone who's savvy enough, can coordinate all of the, as they say, crossing the T's and dotting all the I's mm-hmm. to get that grant in and get the money.
Present the case. This is all the data. This is how we'll use it. This is how we'll monitor it. This is how we'll see our success, et cetera, et cetera.
And it's a full-time job because you gotta know what the requirements are. It's not something you just pick up on a Tuesday afternoon and do.
Even if you just find, okay, there's a new grant, it's going to take hours to gather the research, submit it, and then monitor it through the process because, it may come back and say, you forgot to check this box or you forgot to add this in, et cetera. So there's constant care and tending to that piece.
And I guess the argument I make, so this is Ted making the argument, that the first towns that get there, get in line. Let me just say a nice mm-hmm. way of saying it. The first people there are the ones that will probably get the most payoff, right?
Potentially.
So the early adopters, so to speak, who have a town who has someone in place that is thinking about this stuff is probably going to be able to take advantage of this stuff a year before everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then as more and more towns come on, even with the billions and billions of dollars, there's more and more competition.
Yeah.
Right? So you're
depending
smart
on
to
how
get in
that
early.
Bucket of funds is structured, X amount for this, this, or this, or if it's just in the pool, first come, first serve, then the first ones in line are going to get their cut.
I think that the case that I've been making is that any town in Massachusetts, Franklin in particular, has to recognize that there will be costs coming. Will be costs over the next 20 or 30 years, right?
Oh, for sure.
And we can look at those costs being damage from weather events, cases where you need to be resilient, places where you want to replace your sewer system to make it handle increased rainstorms and
mm-hmm.
stuff. Right? All that stuff's coming. And so you need to think about it and get in line to try and get the money because you're going to have to get the money to pay for it from the federal government because you're going to pay for it one way or the other.
Sure.
And if the federal government's not helping you, you're paying for it on your own or you're suffering. And so the town is wise to be sophisticated and in place in order mm-hmm. to take advantage of these things as they come up.
Right. So. Yeah. And you mentioned sewer, and we are, in fact, redoing our main sewer line. That's called the Beaver Street Interceptor, or BSI for short. Keep Franklin flowing, according to the little poop emoji that's on the social followings, because it's progressively going to detour traffic, but certainly slow down traffic on 140 as it progresses along 140 from up by the Stop and Shop Plaza down to Beaver Street, before it finally finishes in 2026 or 2027,
mm-hmm.
replacing the line that effectively takes 70% of our sewage and brings it into Medway to get processed.
Right.
So it's a significant key piece. The pipe was built 100 years ago. It's old. It's in danger of falling apart. We're going to replace it and build that extra capacity in as well. So that's all well and good. We're fortunate that we did already get through the state 1% interest loan. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
To the extent that they're also looking at, because the EPA, one of our other favorite federal agencies, has mandated stormwater mitigation steps,
right,
which has resulted in our stormwater fee.
So just hang on. To explain that, right? Stormwater, again, you're referring to the idea that, you know, storms will increase in intensity going forward, but they're already pretty bad, and they've always have been. It's not like they haven't been heavy rains, right?
No. Right?
And the way that the towns are set up now is that big parking lots, streets, and everything tend to channel the water, and it gets all dumped into the Charles River, carrying all the ishki from the street and every place else. Now, the Charles is polluted, and doubly so. It hasn't sunk into the aquifer here in Franklin for us to drink.
Right.
And so managing the stormwater is a smart thing to do. Right?
Sure.
And so, but it costs money, and it's upsets people's apple carts, right?
Yes. Yes, for a number of reasons, including the funds, which have to come out of our pocket because it's one of those federally unfunded mandates. They're saying you need to do this and spend, I think it was estimated at $30 million over X number of years. That's not something we can easily afford. So how do we do that? We increase the stormwater fee gradually to do this, do that, et cetera. So now thinking of this other pot of funds, if we can tie some of that from a climate perspective to this mitigation piece, maybe we can kind of do two things with the same dollar.
That's why you have a smart person there who's thinking about these things.
Right.
I mean, the thing that I think would be good is that just like burying the power lines.
Right? True.
Most of Franklin has telephone poles, and then in a big storm, they get knocked over and people are out of power. That's increasingly dangerous as everyone's driving an electric vehicle and heating their home with a with a heat pump, right?
Sure.
So one of the things you'd want to do from a resiliency perspective, it seems to me, is to have all those lines buried underground so that they're less likely to be interrupted, shall we say.
Right.
And, of course, that's big bucks. Right?
That's
now,
major.
Whether or not there's money for that in the IRA, I don't know.
Right. Yeah,
but I'm just saying that there you can easily start a list of things that you would say from a climate perspective we should be thinking about X, Y, and Z, and it's great to think about it, but how are you going to pay for it? And if the feds are there with the checkbook open, right, then we should try and take advantage of that because again, this is just reality. These things are going to come at us. These requirements from Mother Nature are coming, so we should think about them now.
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting. The other piece that certainly ties into this, and we didn't talk about it beforehand, but I think you'll agree that it does tie very well. So in terms of the long-term planning, there's this master plan update committee that is soon to be bringing out the goals and objectives across a variety of areas. So transportation, housing, sustainability, open space, recreation, things of that sort. As residents, we should be aware when those goals and objectives come out, look at them, question them where necessary, and maybe get into the discussion around tweaking them. So I would anticipate that something in that sustainability space would have this manager, director, whatever we call it, focal point in there. And if it's not, that would be an opportunity for us to advocate for that as well. And it's still just because it's in there, it should happen within the next 10 years, but the government certainly will have it on its agenda. And we've talked here and in my other conversations, governments move slowly because you have to build that consensus. Things have to be prepared for. It takes a lot of discussions to finally build that consensus to say, yeah, that's a good thing. Now's a good time. Let's do it. As opposed to, we're not ready for that yet.
And I agree, but the slow pace of government is in distinction to the inexorable clock that is ticking, right? I mean, that, you know, the year 2030 has been sort of made iconic, right? So you hear about, I start my other podcast by saying
6 years away.
6 years away. It's something like 2,000 days, right? You do the arithmetic. How many days until the year 2030, right? And it is, and the argument has been that by 2030, we must reduce our greenhouse gases by 50%. Right, and but as a globe, right, and in the United States, maybe even more. Right, so that's a big ticket. You know, I've seen reports that say we've already blown the budget. Hang on. So the reason that the statement is that you have to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 50% by the year 2030, in order to have in order to have a 50% chance of keeping the global temperature below a 1.5 degree rise, right?
Right.
So that's a long statement. I'll say it again, that we have to cut our greenhouse gas emissions by 50% by the year 2030 in order to set up the planet to have a 50% chance, a one out of two chance to remain, to keep the temperature rise below 1.5 degrees centigrade, which is a number that basically conceivably allows the island states in the Pacific to continue to exist and other bad things
to not happen.
To not happen, right? I've seen things that say we've already blown past that, right? Mm-hmm. And that, but still in all, there's no, I guess the original point is that government may be slow, but that's part of the excruciating thing about the climate crisis is that Mother Nature doesn't care, mm-hmm. right? It's just marching on. It's got its own timing for things that happen, and they don't care if the city council isn't quite ready to decide, or the federal government, or anybody. I mean, I'm not mocking anyone, right? Right. But I mean, human plans mean nothing to the planet, and until we get our brain around that, we're going to be behind the eight ball.
Yes, therein lies the challenge.
Yes,
because even as slow as town government can be. And it can take a few years to get something from an idea to happening. Federal government, we know, in many cases, is even slower. So. Yeah. And then trying to coordinate at a world level, you certainly have some nations who are ready to do so, some nations who financially have no wherewithal, really, to try and step up because they just...
Well, speaking
of that status, and I know we've gotten into some of that economic justice piece.
But let me just go sideways for something we hadn't prepared for. But there's ongoing elections in Europe right now.
True.
And it turned out that many of the sort of the center held, so to speak, but the right wing has gained more power in Europe.
Sure.
Right? Reflecting a sort of global trend towards authoritarianism, right, which we see here in the United States.
Right.
And some of that right-wing trending in Europe will be at the expense of climate issues.
Yes.
Right? And that it's just a fact. I mean, again, the government slows down. We've only got 2,000 days till the year 2030. Yeah, you're in this maelstrom of concern. But that's why here in the United States, everybody needs to vote. Everyone needs to know what they're voting for and what the consequences of their vote will be, because we have our own big decisions here. But it's a global questions.
And longevity of humanity as we know it, maybe knew it, is certainly going to be challenged by things that are coming, because we can already look around and see the economic disasters resulting from the planetary challenges, whether it's thunderstorms or forest fires or tornadoes, or all of those things are just increasing in frequency and intensity.
Well, we're lucky right now because there's a big heat dome in the Southwest, right? Los Angeles and Arizona, and they're all like 100 and... So let me just... There's something called the wet bulb temperature, right? There's a temperature and humidity combination of temperature and humidity above which the human body cannot get the heat out of itself,
right?
That the air is too humid, your sweat doesn't carry away any heat, so your body just overheats. And that we are sort of creeping up on these hot days, right, of approaching the wet bulb temperature that is bad for humans and just thought you'd want that. It's a cheery thought on this wonderful, this beautiful June day outside. That's not the most cheerful thought.
No, but it's another aspect of these things that we're seeing, and, you know, it's weather, it's going to change, but the intensity and the frequency of these things is not weather. That's climate.
That's
the real distinction between the two.
Yeah.
And thereby, hopefully, and we've talked about how realistically it is, but at some point in time, people should wake up and say, oh, we do need to change. And how do we change? Because change is going to have to happen sooner than later.
So here's a change for you, a positive change for you. Down in Mexico, they had an election. So it turns out that 2024, there's like elections all over the world. Like
sure.
Three-quarters
it's a good
of the 4-year
cycle.
Yeah, three-quarters of people in the world are voting for new presidents. But in Mexico, they elected a woman named Claudia Sheinbaum as president of Mexico. And what makes her, well, two things. One is the first woman to be elected president of Mexico.
Yay.
And
yay.
That I guess women were given the vote, were given. I'll just let me. Women
allowed
had the vote.
To vote.
Allowed to vote, yes, in only 70 years ago. Right? So they elected a president. But the cool thing from my perspective is that President Sheinbaum is a climate scientist educated at the University of California, Berkeley, with a doctorate in energy science. Mm. And so that's great. Right, because this
potentially,
is,
yeah. What assuming she can bring that to bear in her new role in her office,
well,
and one
the,
could see how could she not? I mean, really.
What I saw was that California and Mexico already have a lot of climate collaborative stuff because
sure.
they share, right? They share a lot. They share a coastline. They share a lot of things, and so that this is a good sign for constructive collaboration.
Yes.
It's interesting because, to warm to my subject, that what it does is it tells you that like cities can talk to cities, that it doesn't have to be nation state to nation state.
True.
Like, it doesn't have to be United States talking to Mexico. California can talk to Mexico and make a deal.
Mm-hmm.
New York, Miami can talk to Dakar and Bangladesh, right, where they're both sinking into the water, right?
Mm-hmm.
Venice, Miami, and these places on the
they have
Asia-Pacific
a common
land,
interest in that area.
They have a common interest, and they can share expertise, right? And there are places like the Desert Southwest can work with places in Africa because they share common problems. And that is a sort of different way of imagining global collaboration and a global response
mm-hmm.
that doesn't require a top-down United Nations.
No.
You know, the United States and Russia and France all get together and they decide and then it all...
Mm-hmm.
No, it's like these. You can have these realistic working relationships at many levels. And what it does is it begins to challenge the whole concept of nation state as the actor.
Right.
Right? And I've said before, we have said on the show, I mean, nation state, that is to say, all these little countries that are at the United Nations, they're all post-World War II things. I mean, a big swath of humanity was like in the British Empire in the 1930s.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And so now we've invented this idea of everyone having a nation, and we say, well, that's the end of history. Every nation, that's it. We have to solve all problems through the nation-state apparatus. And say, no, there's other ways to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So. That's spitballing the next 50 years.
No, I agree with that wholeheartedly, to the extent that having had a number of bits of experience, bits is probably not the proper term, but it just came to mind and stuck out. Over the years, there has been a number of communities, primarily around a lot of the social tools, podcasting, blogging, video blogging, et cetera, that through the unconference format bring together people of various around a central interest, but that same unconference piece can have, as long as you've got a central interest, you can bring people together and they can then, the synergy that happens is magic in many cases because you can plan some things and some things just happen that you perhaps hadn't planned.
Right.
You may have wished for, but you weren't sure it was going to happen. And yea, verily, it can happen. So that grassroots operation, truly at ground level community engagement,
right.
That is definitely a way to go.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one of the blessings of the internet. I mean, right now the internet is a curse, right? It's a cesspool of misinformation and whatnot. But it's also a marvelous mechanism. A connector of people that would not, as you say, if you can find a common interest, then you're able to talk to people, and that matters, right?
Yes.
And so, yeah, I think that in the response to the climate crisis at the global level may well end up, I mean, we may look back and say that it was not the United Nations that solved all the problems. It was connections created at peer-to-peer level up and down the hierarchy, right?
Right.
From state to state, down to city to city, and, you know, probably person to person.
Yeah, so we've talked about the United Nations and the COP, which is an acronym for that, COP.
Conference of the Parties.
Conference of the Parties. And they are the ones that come up with the guidelines, the rules, the Paris Agreement, a Paris Accord, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, clearly that is not making as much progress as we need. So this community call to action, you know, at this lower level can
make
some connections. And
there's something called the C40. I'd have to Google it. I believe it's the C40. And it was started by Michael Bloomberg, who was the mayor of New York, gazillionaire guy, but also a person who recognized climate. And this C40 thing is a deliberate attempt to connect something like 40 biggest cities together to talk about climate issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, when I look on my news feed, I see things like Paris has basically changed itself in the course of a decade over to a primarily bike city.
Right.
Right?
Right.
That's a great example. And if Paris can do it, Boston could do it. Franklin could do it. Right? I mean, it's not impossible.
No.
And you get these examples through that sort of that level of communication.
Two heads are better than one. Many minds are even better than two. So.
But anyway, we congratulate Claudia Sheinbaum in Mexico.
For sure.
And that is a good thing. It'll be interesting to see how that all evolves, right? That was the starting point of that little digression we went off on.
Within the scope.
Within the scope. But it's very interesting to see because, for example, Mexico has... Oh God! It's a sovereign oil company. So what's she going to do with that?
Right.
Right. I mean, a lot of money comes in from that.
Sure.
You can't not, if you're the president, it'd be irresponsible to not sell it. But on the other hand, if you're a climate scientist, you know that you can't. We can't keep burning it, right? So how do you go?
Yeah.
So Claudia Sheinbaum has challenges. Let me use that as a segue to a different challenge. I think you maybe know what this is. It turns out that all right, so let's level set here. We're heading into the end of the legislative session. The climate omnibus bill is being formulated in the basement somewhere of the State House and will pop out later, sometime before mid-July.
Okay.
It turns out that in the climate bill, there's some moves afoot. And I'll explain what the moves are. But the basis is that the wind turbine development has not gone as fast as the state had wanted. So the state's operating on the budget that says we need to cut our climate emissions by 50% by the year 2030. They take it seriously. God bless them. That's right. We need to cut climate emissions in Massachusetts by 50% by 2030. They were going to have a whole bunch of wind turbines. Then Mr. Putin started Ukraine and supply, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
The wind turbine industry has slowed down a little bit because for various reasons, they can't get the wind turbines built quickly enough.
Things
have changed.
Some of their models are kind of out of whack and they're trying to redo them and figure out, okay, how can we make this?
And so the state legislators are looking around saying, how are we going to get electricity to keep the lights on going forward? And it turns out that there are two sources of electricity that some people love and some people hate, but they're nuclear power plants out in the West. There's one in Vermont and there's one in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
that are currently running, generating clean power. Now, as you may remember, here in the eastern part of the state, the Pilgrim Power Plant shut down. There are two nuclear power plants, which basically, it's very expensive, but they're up and running.
Mm-hmm.
So the state, in the omnibus bill, the state is considering declaring nuclear energy to be a form, an acceptable form of clean energy.
As a transition to...
Well, as a form of clean energy, because there's no immediate carbon produced when you make when you use a nuclear reactor to make power.
Right.
You're not burning any fossil fuel. So,
true.
Okay.
You still have to deal with the lifetime of the waste.
Yes, I mean, there's many, many, many issues here. But Beacon Hill, they're looking to say, where are we going to get electricity? These plants exist. What should we do?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a move to allow the nuclear plants to be considered clean energy. And then they get to bid and offer their electricity in the same way that a wind-generating farm would.
Okay.
Okay? Long-term contract, track 20 years, blah, 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 blah. Now, if you can keep the plant alive for 20 years, keep the nuclear plant going for another 20 years, great, right? It's going to be expensive, but it's in place. And for me, personally, this is a real conundrum because you want to keep the power on,
mm-hmm.
right? These plants exist.
And we're going to need more of it anyway with other things going on. Yeah.
But the issue that I have is that if you allow the nuclear plants to make big profits on a 20-year contract to provide power, what that does is it competes with other forms of truly renewable energy,
mm-hmm.
like wind turbines or solar panels.
Right.
Now, you can say, well, the wind turbine's slowing down. Fine, but that's going to turn around, right?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you don't need, a 20-year contract with a nuclear power plant is the 20 years where you're not going to be building wind turbines.
Right.
And that, for my money, somehow the local construction of renewable energy systems, be that batteries, solar, whatever, or efficiency, I mean, all that kind of stuff, that is to be preferred over the nuclear power to give. Now, then you really get into the weeds and say, well, okay, the nuclear guys can compete, but they don't get any subsidies, or they have to charge less, or
structure the deal in such a way
that you don't hurt the renewable, what I would call a true renewable energy, the solar panels and wind turbines, right? So that's a subtlety that really gets down into the weeds, and of course, keeping those plants alive out in the western part of the state. Maybe here on the east, in the eastern part of the state, we say, sure, fine. But there's some people have to live next door to that nuclear power plant. And we still have to figure out what to do with all the ishki that comes out of it after it's done running.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
it's a difficult choice. And I'm not sure where I come down on it. I mean, I sort of think if you're going to allow nuclear power into the system, you got to do it carefully. And so let me just, one other story here about nuclear power. So the way the electricity grid works,
mm-hmm.
okay, is that every hour, let's say every hour, every company that is making electricity offers their electricity and says, it says to ISO New England, I will sell you my wind power for 2 cents for a kilowatt hour. And the coal plant says, I will sell it to you for 2.1 cents per kilowatt hour. And the solar panel people say, I will give it to you for some other number, right? So everybody is ranked. And then what they do is the grid guys take the lowest bid and they put that, and then they stack what's called stacking the bids. So I can get, 500 kilowatt hours at 1 cent an hour. I get another 2 kilowatt at 2 cents an hour. Then I get more at 3 cents an hour. I get, and so you finally reach this highest price and you satisfy the demand and everybody gets paid the highest price.
Ooh.
Well,
okay.
That's how it works.
That's how it works today.
That's how it works today. So what happens is the nuclear power plants, they always say, I will give you my power for 0 cents. right? So they're always in the mix, right? They are always in this stack up because they're bidding in, they're offering their power at $0 per kilowatt hour, mm-hmm. and then they get paid whatever the most expensive producer is because that's just how the system is set up to work.
And they're happy with whatever they get.
But the fact that they're an existing plant, right, and they've essentially sunk all the costs and all the development, so they're just going to be making money and they're going to be bidding in at 0 cents on the dollar, making money in competition with the solar panel people. I just got agitated over that. I don't think it's a good way to go. On the other hand, nuclear power, as they say, is kind of firm. So here's another term for you: firm power, which is kind of a, I don't know, ugly term, but firm power is basically something that you can rely on. It doesn't depend on whether or not the sun's up or whether or not the wind's blowing. Right? So you can turn a switch and you get the power.
It's more dependable in some other sources.
It's claimed to be more dependable. Now, you can argue that even nuclear power plants and coal plants go off, they have downtime, right?
Yeah.
But the nuclear power plant, when it's on, is producing mm-hmm. all the time.
Sure.
So that's an advantage,
yep.
right? So there's advantages and disadvantages, and no one has yet seen the deal that the State House is willing to sign up to for managing, allowing nuclear power onto the grid.
Mm-hmm.
But I hope they do it in a way that does not discourage the goal that we want to get to, which is a lot of people employed putting up wind turbines and solar panels, right? That's where the magic is.
Sure. Yeah, and just even in that pricing model, for lack of a better term, it's a process. I'm sure it's probably not the most optimal, but we'd also have to look carefully because with any model, somebody's going to figure out a way to game it. So you have to do the models and figure out, okay, going back to the math, what's the probability of somebody gaming it to do this versus that and see how it works out? And maybe instead of stacking up to meet the demand and then being at the high price, maybe it's more of a weighted average of the price or something of that, like just speculating, thinking out loud and see what happens. And maybe there's a math major out there who wants to do some modeling.
Well, I tell you, I've found the whole grid stuff to be interesting because all that market where there's bids and that's all run by ISO New England.
Correct.
Which is not beholden to any state.
No. There are other ISO groups in certain regions of the country.
Right. All chartered through the federal energy, the FERC, the Federal Energy
Regulatory
Commission. Yeah. Yep. But these... Like ISO is a corporation; it's beholden to itself, and so to change the markets and the rules by which they sell electricity mm-hmm. is very difficult.
Mm-hmm. It's an administrative creation to manage the market in something of a rather fluid situation. No pun intended there, because electricity does flow, not like a river does flow, but they certainly that's where. The firmer rivers are the ones that they want, the idle streams to really play with that one.
the place where you're going to go, it's very interesting stuff. You can talk about the duck curve out in California where at noontime in California, they're making more power than they can use, right? So effectively, the price of electricity in California goes negative because they don't. And that is the opportunity when you are making more electricity than you can use. That's when you want to put it into a battery and save it for the nighttime.
So
those kinds of strategies,
or sell it off to somebody who can use it in that period when they don't have enough.
If you're going to sell it from California somewhere else, then you need a national
grid connector.
That connectors, and of course, that's more money that somebody has to pay for the federal government to build that grid.
Because we referenced at one point in time, Texas has some unique problems because Texas is unto itself. It doesn't have connections with the grids.
Well, I heard somewhere that after the debacle of the last several years, they now are like talking to Louisiana some sort of a safety net in case mm-hmm. bad things happen. But
yeah. Right.
Well, I mean, again, from a climate perspective, if we're going to move to have everything run on electricity, then the distribution of electricity has to be incredibly reliable. In addition to being more copious production, we need to...
Sure.
And so all these issues come into play.
Right? Well, and that's where even to the extent that at a more local level, somebody who's got a solar service on their house, generally they could have kind of their own battery storage. But then at some point in time, they could put stuff back into the grid and have that, you know, reverse metered in such a way. Obviously, yeah, you still need the computer system really to keep track of all those ins and outs and balances, et cetera. It can get complicated, but it's doable.
We
to
have
calculate.
The technology, as somebody said. Yeah,
we should have that technology. That's for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, speaking of flowing things, I heard a little birdie told me that the geothermal heating system in Framingham might have started to operate. The geothermal heating. So here's the deal. Here's the idea that if you have, so now what we're talking about is home heating. So we've switched. I hope you don't have whiplash. Mm-hmm. We just switched from the grid to heating your house. Okay. But the idea is that if you have a dense neighborhood with houses right next to each other, and out in the street there is a gas pipeline that is feeding methane gas into each home to run a gas heater in the basement. An alternative plan would be to put pipes in the street that carry water of a good temperature into the house, and that would help a heat pump in the house operate very efficiently, or work the best it could.
Right.
Okay? And so now instead of having gas flowing into your house, you have water flowing into your house, and that the obtaining that perfect temperature water is done by drilling a hole down into the earth called a geothermal well that brings up water that is basically at the right temperatures, 50 degrees C from way down, and that's what they're pumping through these pipes instead of methane natural gas, and that's what so now. The reason I started down this path is because you say when you have a solar panel on your roof, you can, if you have excess power, you can put it back on the grid, right? You can, and you get paid for it. Well, the same is true if you have this geo-micro district, because if there's, say, a company that is producing more heat than it's using, it can warm the water up and pass that on to the next house, and then they take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm.
Long and short, there is a pilot project to do this kind of geothermal micro district up in Framingham. And Steve, my understanding is that it's close to turning on after several years.
I recall seeing, I know it cut, the groundbreaking was in April. So the fact that it already got turned on in June is a little early on the one hand, but that's what I recall seeing across one of the social channels in terms of a news headline. Mm-hmm. I haven't been able to, confirm that at this point.
We need to find someone to talk to about that, because it is a fascinating, the idea that it's almost, it harkens back to, steam systems. Like if you go to New York, they're pumping steam from building to building all around, right?
Yep.
You do the same thing with geothermal water, right?
And having visited Iceland, which certainly sits nicely in the Atlantic at the juncture of a couple of tectonic plates. It has a giant geothermal aquifer, for that term to use, to tap into. So I think it's 70% of their electricity is generated through geothermal today.
Right.
So we can learn from that. Clearly, we may not have Iceland's natural resources to the extent that we do, but there are places a la Yellowstone and other places in the West that are spots that would be natural to that.
I want to be clear. There's one geothermal heating system concept that says, I'm going to drill a hole down into the ground and I'm going to get water that is hot.
Hot, correct.
It's going to be 200 degrees of, ready to boil. It's that hot. And I can use that to heat stuff directly.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. That's one. And I think that's what happens in Iceland, because they're all sitting
on
all these fault lines.
Yep.
There's a second concept of geothermal is that you go down only you know, a
couple hundred feet.
Couple hundred feet, and you get water that is only, let's say, 100 degrees Fahrenheit, right? That, or it's 50, no, it's 50 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right.
50, which is, 50 degrees is nice because it's cool in the summer and hot in the winter.
Right? And constant.
And constant all year long. And that 50-degree water isn't used to directly heat your home, but is used as the reference material for a heat pump. Mm-hmm. So the heat, your heat pump is sucking heat out of that 50-degree water or putting heat into it, and fine. That's the second concept. That's what's in Framingham, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And the other idea of drilling, having these geothermal hot water things like Iceland, I saw 18 months ago a thing where the MIT guys had developed a drill bit for drilling wells. The drill bit was not a physical bit. It was a plasma torch, and that they could drill like 10 miles into the earth where the water is like 5,000 degrees, right? And you could do it anywhere, right? It wouldn't depend. You could do it here in Franklin, right? If you know, and that is this whole other opportunity to get directly high quality, hot water,
right,
and use that to do what you want with.
So. Yeah.
There's a lot of ways to skin the cat that don't involve nuclear power, but
or harming cats. No harm intended, that's for sure. I think we've kind of wandered a few different paths. Hopefully, made a little bit more sense of some of the topics that are out there. So, listeners, if you have indeed followed us along the way and want us to tackle some other topic along the line, our contact info is in the show notes, so you can reach out and we shall tackle that in a future episode. And otherwise, thanks, Ted. It's been a fun journey.
Interesting conversation. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
And we do this because Franklin matters. We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.